kutukana mtazoana.
Capital 263.
What would you make of his legacy in terms of the leadership of the MDC from when it began up to now, up to, you know, the end of his time? What would you make of that, of particularly focusing on the MDC?
I think that's where his greatest successes are and also his greatest failings are. I do believe the decision that was made to get rid of term limits in the MDC was the beginning of the end for his unassailable position of being Democrat, 100% Democrat. The reasons behind that were, I guess, one could argue they were practical more than anything. One could argue the people said it, the people wanted it. One could argue he wanted Congress even though he was being challenged, but I don't know. All I'm saying, all I know is that 2005, the MDC before 2005 and the MDC after 2005 were very different things. Not only because it was now the MDCT, but more because it was no longer as broad based. There was now a opposition political class, whereas before they had genuinely been drawn from all sectors. But I think their failure to gain to win the elections in 2005 created what your first opposition career opposition politicians, and that's where he began to, in my opinion, lose his way politically, at least. There was still good work to be done, but I don't think that work should have been done post 2008 from the presidency of the MDC.
Openyu, any?
I think the hardest thing, when you are the bearer of the vision, when you're the carrier of the vision, which Mr. Tsvangirai so obviously was with the MDC from its founding, when you're the carrier, when you're the one who has the flag that everybody follows in terms of the democratic fight, and you're essentially Moses leading the people to the promised land, I think it's very difficult to know at what point you need to let go, because so much of what is done, so many of the compromises that you have to make, particularly when you are at war, and let's face it, it's a kind of war. It's difficult to know. And so much of the things you have to compromise look so different from what you had envisioned. The glory of, you know, battle and the sweet taste of victory is not as sweet. Battle is not as glorious. And sometimes your losses are far more than what you had anticipated or even prepared for. So I can sympathize with him in not being able to let go of the vision and in not being able to pass the flag on to another person. That being said, I don't condone it. And I do think that there did come a point where he should have allowed another person to become the vision carrier and for him to become a wheel in the machinery of the thing that he was trying to achieve. And so it got lost. It got lost when the MDC constitution was changed. There were many more compromises in terms of leadership than there were in terms of political gains and political losses in the fight for democracy against ZANU-PF. And, you know, I think that takes away from the legacy that I think, you know, at the outset, I believe anyone who starts something so vast and so big, and particularly so, you know, strong, because you're fighting a monolithic entity. ZANU-PF is, in essence, a monolith, right? But it's if he had stuck with the vision, if he had put the vision first, and that's not to say that he didn't, I don't know, but for me as a person watching, and for me as a person who very much bought into the vision at the very, very beginning, felt like, at some point, it felt like he let go of the vision. So, yeah, for me, you know, it's a complicated, I have a complicated relationship with everybody, Mugabe, Mnangagwa, Changirai, so... you know, so for me, it's complicated. I want to love him. I just feel betrayed by him. Does that? So,
yeah. Yeah. I completely understand. And before I comment, I wanted to ask another question. I suppose I've got quite a few questions. On 2008, I think, you know, before we look at some of the problematic things, 2008, the elections came. And he won the election, beat less than 40. He beat Mugabe. Let's start at the fact that he beat Mugabe. And obviously, the election results came took very long to come out. I remember there was a curfew on, and he was staying at the Norwegian embassy. I think it was for some time, and he refused to run in the runoff election. And obviously, you know, after that, we all know what happens. We then ended up with a unity government. What do you guys think about that? Do you think he made the right decisions at that time? Obviously, in hindsight, the vision is better. But in his position at that time, did he make the right choices, choosing not to participate in the runoff, entering the unity government?
Yes. I don't know about entering the, look, there's two questions there. Did he choose the right thing and not running in the runoff? Yes.
Yep.
Part of the work I did when I was working for TB Law was, collect stories. I don't know if they're for archives or what. So I've spoken to, I think I did about 50 of them, where we would get people that were victims of political violence. And a lot of them came from 2008, that political runoff. And the week leading up to the runoff...
it was bloody.
It was... I'm trying to... Like, it deserves its own episode, and I've got this information. I've got the recordings of these people telling of their experiences. People who were known to be MDC activists had their IDs taken away from them so that they couldn't vote. Regular people were forced into Pungwe for the whole entire week. I met mothers who didn't bath for a whole week and were breastfeeding, but weren't being fed but once a day by people who are in government now, people who are ministers now, who are part of this. And I think that's where his famous quote was, that he won't go to State House, he won't go to the presidency over the bodies of Zimbabweans. And hindsight is perfect, and it might be easy to say he should have run in that runoff because you'd have won. But people don't realize that.
No, which is why I didn't want to look at it from a hindsight perspective. I'm focusing more on,
and
you
at
know,
that
where
moment,
he was.
At that moment, people were. It was, if he had run, he couldn't have guaranteed, not even just his own safety. He couldn't have guaranteed anyone's safety in the country.
And there was no indication.
Yeah?
Sorry. Well, I was going to say, yes, I agree with all of the above, but when you're cornered, there's always a window. And the runoff was not the only option available. And again, hindsight. But I said it then, and I'll say it again 10 years later. That was not the only option available to him. He shouldn't have been in the runoff, but neither did he have to accept a GNU, because he did win the election. The election was clearly his. But for there to have been a GNU, for ZANU-PF to have come to a table, their hand was forced. And for me, that shows me that they were in a position of weakness, and he actually did have the upper hand, and he compromised the upper hand that he did have. And yes, people's lives are important. But the thing is that, you know, 10 years later, we're still in a bad relationship with a toxic ZANU-PF that we apparently can't seem to get out of, despite a not a coup. So, and I blame him for that. I do think that,
I mean,
he should have held out. He should have said, no, I'm not going to grant you legitimacy, ZANU-PF.
I think it's a difficult position, because you also have to understand that 2008 was the height of, you know,
of the economic crisis.
And there was so much happened that year in terms of politics and economy that Zimbabweans were...
Sorry to cut you off, Chris.
No.
The world had just watched Kenyans maim and kill each other in 2007.
Yes.
When this election happened and this situation happened, mm-hmm. The GNU didn't come from Zimbabwe. Mbeki flew to Harare.
Yes.
As soon as the end of the runoff, and said, you guys, we're negotiating this. There's no other way. People tried to hold out, whatever, but they eventually were convinced. But essentially, the argument that everyone was making, and I was 18. That was when at my height of you know, being involved and looking at the politics, reading ZimSituation.com, which was run by Anna. I'm sure these guys are now running proper newspapers, but the whole argument at the time was, we can't have another Kenya. The whole entire world wanted to avoid what was going on in Kenya.
I remember that.
All the leaders, everyone. Hindsight is 2020. And as a young person, it would have been easy to say, let's go to the streets and everything like that. But I think it was a tough political decision to make.
Yeah,
I think it was a very difficult decision. I agree with you. I think it was a very difficult decision to make. But I also think that if we are saying that we've been in a fight for democracy for the last 20 odd years, and if we're saying that this is democracy is the thing that we want, then you're going to have to bite the bullet and admit that you have to make sacrifices. You have to make unhappy, difficult choices.
I think it's difficult.
That was one of them.
I think it's difficult, especially when you are sacrificing other people's lives, because it's all fair and fine for them to hold out, but from the position they were sitting in, you know, they were in relative comfort. But you start to think of the people of Zimbabwe, and as I said, we must not forget the context. 2008 was a harsh, harsh year.
But do you not think that the reason why ZANU-PF still has power is because they're prepared to make that exact sacrifice? And no one else is. And, you know, I've been saying this repeatedly. Then maybe the thing that we need to talk about is, we're in a one-party state, and ZANU-PF has internal elections, and we don't have opposition politics at all.
Because unless and until
a person arrives on the scene who is prepared to make those kinds of sacrifices, we're always going to be in this relationship.
But the thing is, Upenyu, is, you know, and we're digressing here, but I'll just say that you don't want to make the same choices that those that you are fighting against are making. You want to make better choices, and you find ways to do that. Obviously, again, we must contextualize and think about the situation where they were in 2008. it's very difficult to say we'll let people get maimed, we'll let people die of hunger just because we're going to hold out, because you don't know how long the holdout is going to be. We must also remember that ZANU-PF had, you know, military men who had categorically stated they were not going to salute Tsvangirai, you know, and that's another thing that he had to face up to, is he wasn't just facing a political system, he was facing a political system that had full control of the state and military. So it was an extremely difficult decision. I don't think they woke up and said, you know what, GNU, let's do it. I think there was a lot of deliberation that went into it.
Can I take you back 30 years before
the GNU, when ZANU, ZAPU, the Rhodesian government and the British government and God knows who else sat at the table at Lancaster House. And the thing that, I mean, this is a fairly famous quote, but the thing that convinced Mugabe to sign at the end was when Samora basically said, listen, I'm going to kick you out of my country. If you don't have an army. The people who lived in the camps are refugees. Those are sacrifices. Those are real sacrifices. Right? The people who lived in the camps lived on mangai. You know what a mangai is? It's boiled chibake. And it's not even the whole cob. It's two. It's one or two of those corns that you eat. The people who lived in the camps had no medicines, no schools, nothing. Those are sacrifices. This is who you're dealing with.
Those people went, and
they were prepared to step away from the negotiating table if they didn't get what they wanted.
So I
hear what you're saying, that we're digressing, et cetera, et cetera. But if you are not prepared to match balls for balls at a table with ZANU-PF, you're not going to win. And then what you're basically doing every election is giving ZANU-PF legitimacy because there is an opposition.
So, Upenyu, you're advocating for an opposition to...
I'm advocating for balls of steel. I'm not saying an opposition has to go and march people into cannon fire. That's not what I'm saying at all, because I'm also the same person who says there are smarter ways to campaign and there's better ways to protest than putting people on the streets where they're in harm's way. But at the same time, you have to know who your enemy is. You have to know who you're facing on the battleground.
What we're disagreeing with is your categorization of bravery. And I think it was brave to sit down, and it's a different kind of bravery.
I didn't call him a coward.
It's not
about bravery. It's about, can I face, how far do I have to go to achieve this thing? And it's not about being brave, because the very fact that he can take the beating, the very fact that he can say Mugabe must go, the very fact that he even said, let's form an opposition party, when Edgar Tekere had failed, the very fact, there's no question that he was a brave person. But when it comes to the decision in 2008, 2009 to sign for the GNU, I do not think he had the stomach for the things he had to do. And that doesn't mean he wasn't brave. It just means that he couldn't stomach that scale of suffering. But when who's seen suffering on a completely different level, who's watched people being burnt alive, that's how do you deal with somebody like that? Because they've drawn the battlefield. You're playing by the rules of their game, are you not?
I think it's a complex situation that they found themselves in, and you're holding people's lives in your hand, and it's very difficult to, you know, making certain decisions is a very difficult thing, and it's not black and white, it's very many shades of gray. What we can discuss, and you know, a question is his tenure as prime minister. You know, that's what do you guys make of the time that, you know, he was in government and he was prime minister, and then everything that came subsequent to that, his role as the leader of the MDC whilst he is also in government, and dealing with, you know, the state that you had been fighting the last 10 years, now you're both sitting at the table and you're both having to work together?
Here I can comment quite honestly. I think they. This is Benju. This is where your point probably is more salient. That they
have you been dishonest? They didn't have before.
Pardon?
I said, were you being dishonest the whole time?
What's this?
Ian.
Ian Tawanda Gahanti said, now I can comment more honestly.
No, that was... Sorry, I was... It's... No. Shy, guys. Allow me. It's 7 a.m. morning now. I've been up since... quickly. This is opinion... This is, at this point, this is where your points... Your argument is actually more, for me, more salient. If there had a number of things happened during the GNU that they should have walked away from, and they should have left the GNU, I think that's where they showed they didn't have the balls of steel. That's where they didn't use their advantage. I think a number of times during the GNU they should have walked away. This situation, I think that people... like to say Mugabe outfoxed Tsvangirai in the government. I think he tried, certainly. He had all the levers of power of the state, certainly. He was used to statecraft in its most Machiavellian form, certainly. But the real failing of the GNU was because Mbeki was ousted in South Africa. So the facilitator of the agreement was no longer there, and they no longer had anyone in SADC who was ensuring that the spirit and the letter of the GNU was followed anymore, because Zuma had no interest in, and whoever followed Zuma, what's his name, whoever followed Mbeki, whatever his name is, had no interest in that. Mohlantle, that one, had no interest in ensuring that the GNU was implemented. And I think a number of breaches should have led them to walk away from that. That's for me is the biggest leadership failing or problem in the GNU. What wasn't a problem is the Prime Minister's office and as part of the campaign and as part of their time in government, we got the new Zimbabwean constitution, a constitution that they had fought for since 2000, a constitution that was not wanted in its current form by ZANU-PF for the most part, or by Mugabe specifically, a constitution that... When you go back, and what we were talking about, when you go back to the beginning of this whole story, a constitution that essentially was the reason that there was the need for an opposition to be launched in the first place, amongst other things. So that, and my understanding from my guys and from a lot of other people is that he had a lot to do with mediating the battles within COPAC, as well as placating some of the more radical elements in ZANU from refusing some of the more liberal provisions in the constitution, and fighting that battle. So yeah, that's I think on paper, I guess. And the Zimbabwean constitution is robust and is truly something to be proud of. And so at the end of the day, that's pretty much all we got from, in honesty, from the GNU on the political side. And I think that a lot of that can be accounted to his tenacity.
Upenyu?
No, you answer the question, Chris. You've been asking us questions like your interview. You answer your own question.
Chris is following people's advice. If you have nothing to say, nice to say.
Don't say anything.
On the spot.
No, you know what? Today's one of those days where thinking is quite difficult, so it's easier to just play a journalist and ask questions. But I think, you know, it was a very difficult time. I think they found themselves in a very difficult space. You know, they just agreed to this GNU, and now the roles, I don't think, were clearly defined. Also, you're dealing with a ZANU-PF that's agreed to a GNU, but is not accommodative. And, you know, that can be seen. There are many reports that came from that time of how, you know, ministers just wouldn't engage with Tsvangirai as the prime minister. They wouldn't attend meetings and that sort of thing. And like Henry mentioned, there were times when I think they could have or should have, you know, walked away from it. Put your foot down, threaten to do it at least.
They did many times from as early as 2010.
Did they?
Many. I mean, I remember writing about how the MDC shouldn't. Yeah, I've been tuckering them for a long time. How the MDC shouldn't be naive and they should either suck it up or walk away. In 2010 and 2012, but because I worked for an NGO at the time, and so, you know, it was our job to sort of catalog what was going on with the GNU at the time. And from as early as 2010, the MDC was threatening to walk away, MDCT, sorry, was threatening to walk away from the GNU because of disrespect of the Prime Minister's office, because there was the letter and spirit of the agreement was not being followed by ZANU-PF. There was one time when the police arrested, I think it was political activists, and Mohadi was cited in a number of reports about, you know, violations, human rights violations during the time of the GNU. So they did many, many times.
So if they'd threatened it, then they should have taken some sort of action. I don't have the details here. So I think they were in a very difficult position. What I do criticize from that era was the planning going forward, because ZANU-PF had taken a hiding in 2008, and obviously they weren't going to let that happen again come 2013. And it didn't seem, I mean, obviously hindsight again 2020, but I don't know what the MDC could have done in that period, or should have been doing in that period, that they weren't building up to the 2013 elections. We spoke about his legacy. You guys spoke about that, and you know, within the MDC, within the opposition space, he is most certainly an icon and a legend. Within the MDC itself, he contributed to a lot of the problems that they faced. And this starts, you know, way back in 2005, where they had a dispute over the Senate, and he overruled the vote there, and obviously Walshman and et cetera then left. And I think
and et cetera.
Imagine
you worked your whole life as a politician to be called etc. Wow.
So I think you know, that is where the question is within the MDC itself. You know, what his contribution there. There are problems that are within that space, and you know, these problems went all the way up to now. You know, he's created some of the issues that are there. So it's again, it comes back to that thing of when you look at an individual, there are so many different facets to them, and you can look at certain aspects of their legacy in different spaces. I honestly wonder what it would have been had 2013 come around and he had you know, said, I've run my race, I've taken it as far as I can, I will remain part of the party, but I'm not going to take it to the next leg.
Yeah, that's a good scenario to think of, but I suppose we'll never know. What I can say is in the next 15-20 years, perhaps we'll start to notice retrospectively, because I think we're also a bit close to the events now and just him passing away, the actual impact he had on the politics of Zimbabwe as a whole. I think that I don't know if we're wrapping up now or what, but mm-hmm. I think it highly flawed, as all leaders are, but it's one of those things is that, you know, do people in the time of Mandela think that, oh, he's lucky, he's the one that survived in the prison, we would have done better with whoever and he would have given us land reform, or you know, do people around Martin Luther speak about his own personal issues and the things that he didn't do? I wish he hadn't been so nonviolent in the time, and then years later when you're eulogizing him, as has happened now, really, to a large part, you have opponents and people eulogizing him and speaking of the great he did, same people who are charging him for treason and arresting him. So I guess history will tell, but yeah, blazwa indasha.
I mean, it's again, and I completely agree. As we've been saying, you know, all podcasts long, hindsight 2020, and you know, as time goes on, as new narratives come out, as people share different experiences, as certain things happen, and you get to see different angles, we'll definitely get to learn more and appreciate more. One thing you certainly can't take away from him is his contribution, and that anyone, even Mugabe himself, will tell you, you know, that a lot of things about Tsvangirai and a lot of things about the contribution of Tsvangirai, you know, good or bad, to how Mugabe operated in his life. I wonder now, you know, one thing, I wonder now what then happens to the MDC. Obviously this was a shock. Although you know when someone has cancer that it is a possibility, it still came as a shock, and there, a lot of things have happened within the party since, you know, his passing. There was the Chamisa, was it NEC or NC meeting?
NEC. Sorry, yeah, sorry. No. It's my alarm. Sorry, this is okay. The time I'm meant to be waking up.
So the NEC meeting happened, and Chamisa was made the acting president. This was the day after we found out about the passing of Morgan Tsvangirai, and there was a lot of there's been a lot of things happening around that in the political space, so, and in the family space as well.
So just a quick explanation on what happened there. My understanding, the NEC meeting was called before Morgan Tsvangirai passed away, President Tsvangirai passed away.
Yes.
The meeting was always on that Thursday.
Yes.
The reason for the meeting had been called, and it was obviously internal political machinations, but the meeting had been called because they had to, new information. I think they were saying, good to President Vati, whoever is now acting president needs to change. So that meeting had always been called. I think the meeting was called the previous week. I only saw a message about it on the Monday. When the president, president of the party, Prime Minister Tsvangirai of the nation, I suppose Prime Minister is a correct designation, when he passed away on the Wednesday, the party went ahead with the meeting. There was quorum at the meeting. The question is, can, by leaving the meeting, did Secretary General Monzola cancel it? But what we have right now in the MDC is a fight for the legacy of Morgan and a politician who has decided to use that legacy for his own political gains. And while he has the popular support of the people, even in my supporting of him, it has become a bit distasteful.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I it was Machiavellian. That's exactly what it was. And I understand the politics around the situation, but it because of the man who Tsvangirai was, and again, you know, we can, there's a lot to be said, you know, because you could also say that he created this situation, but it didn't feel right that meeting should happen the way it happened, and the politics of MDC leadership should take precedence on that first or second day over the fact that, you know, Tsvangirai had passed. And throughout this period, we've had different situations. We've had situations with Koko Tsvangirai, you know, coming out, and even now I definitely understand. It's definitely this today's rally and the one yesterday have been used as well as campaign platforms, and it makes sense for that to happen because we're still going to the election, and you know, Chamisa is definitely the front runner now in terms of the leadership of the MDC because he's managed to galvanize the support. I have no issues with it now. I had an issue with it on the first day, because I felt it just, you know, it felt self-serving more than anything.
Yeah, it was it just, like, I have the meeting, I think have the meeting, say, in the whole year period, that was also very strange to me. You know, the resolutions of that meeting were just very strange to me. It just, it left a bit of a sour taste in my mouth. But what we can say, more than anything else, is Tsvangirai created the situation by creating Nelson Chamisa.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. It's unfortunate, but I suppose that goes to, you know, part of his legacy and part of the things that happened. It will be interesting to see how they maneuver and manage. Obviously, right now they definitely are getting the crowds because of the events, because of, you know, Tsvangirai's passing and Tsvangirai's funeral. How they manage to capture that
momentum.
Trust
me, with Chamisa, they even, you're going to vote MDC.
You know, I've said on an earlier episode of this podcast, one of the earlier ones, that I would, if he were the candidate, must have been sometime early last year. At this point, well, I'm not voting because I'm not in the country, but I will reconsider. But yes, you carry on.
Go on, Upenyu.
I wanted to speak for a moment about, you know, the capture of the family. which is, I mean, it's not unique to this particular situation. It happens. I mean, Grace Mugabe, he shall rule from the grave, but who's really giving the orders in that situation? But and it's extremely distasteful. Kushaya un, really. But also, I think family needs to know where they end and where their person's thing begins and ends. And I don't think the family has any place in MDC politics. I don't think, I saw an article on the citizen.co.za about how Changirai's son essentially anointed Nelson Chamisa, which is not his place. I mean, who is he in the greater structures of MDC other than the founder and former president's son? So, you know, I think family, whoever you are in your ordinary life, kanauria mayes ya someone who started something great, no better than to get put yourself because you want a moment in the sun. No better, because it's foolish. You are no one to anoint. Changirai belonged to the people, and it is the people's right to choose who their next leader should be, which is, yeah, it's a whole nother conversation, but I'm not impressed by the family.
Am I not allowed to say what Babongo if I'm Banachamisa?
Eh, but not to then anoint him and say he should be the next
Richard leader. Richard said good to you, Babongo if I'm Bananoso. He didn't. If you read the, listen to the quote article. And what he actually, read the, listen to, the thing is the articles, the,
but
I've
there's
been
the
quite,
other one where Kumanyunda says it should be Nelson, not this other guy.
I don't know about all of that. I'm talking about Richard, I suppose. I'm talking about Richard. Richard, the article says he anointed Chamisa. What he said was that, I'm standing here na Chamisa, this Nelson here is giving me the chance to speak. Ndomun wechidika ifamba na baba wangu ndozoti baba wangu aimure make is asterisk, which isn't a lie. and that's all he said. He never said kuti ndovu he should now be president. He never said that. So he just stated his facts. Anyway, I think we are going into a lot of things now that aren't there.
We're moving on, and we'll definitely be discussing this, the whole MDC issue and its succession politics, a bit more with a lot more
in detail.
Yeah.
What's been going on, Kuzano na Chris? Do a quick reminder. Mukuba mare kopi mazon.
What do you mean, Mukuba mare? Zinuzuri kufamba kuzan PF. As you know, zvitima zvakauya.
I'm joking. That was actually good news.
Exactly.
Let me not be.
To be fair, I actually don't know what's going on in ZANPF right now. I do know that soon we'll be getting to primaries and all of those. You know.
But did we speak about Winknose?
No, we didn't. We need to have a conversation about that at some point. I do know that
did he go back to Parliament with his bank statements?
The thing is, we're going to wrap up. We must wrap up. But this week they are bringing in, I think it's the some ministers and people from so many different places are coming in this week on Thursday and Friday. So I think we can discuss more on that once we have the results.
Temba said he wants to bring in Mugabe. I hope that happens. Imagine the scenes.
They are never bringing in that old man to talk to anyone.
Because the old man will Quincy Jones everyone, guy. He'll start talking like Quincy Jones in that interview.
Anyway.
He'll just start saying everything he wants.
We are digressing further. Any last words on the late Morgan Richard Changirai, said we can wrap up and then we can have our discussions offline.
I hope may his soul rest in peace.
Yeah, I've said a lot, but yeah, Famba Mushesawe, and whether they called you a national hero or not, I think you've proved to everyone that you are, and you get to join Susan now.
I hope that different people, or the MDC actually, puts a project together to chronicle his life. I think we definitely deserve a biography and a documentary, actually. So I think there's a lot of work that can be done, and there's a lot of conversations that can be had with so many different people. He's worked with a lot of people over the years and over his political career, and it would be really great if the MDC, and it should be a project that comes out of the MDC, they put something together for history, for themselves, and for the people of Zimbabwe.
Yeah, definitely. That's it for me.
Thanks for listening. Find us, as always, Politics and Beyond on on Facebook, Poly and Beyond ZW on Twitter. And now. Capital 263.